Well, what have you been doing besides powdering your nose?
Wait a minute, maybe he's got something there.
Please hang up and try again.
Welcome to thedigitaltrekker.com. I'm Matt Brandon, and this is the Digital Trekker Podcast.
This is a podcast that we normally do at the end of a workshop. And of course, it's my co-host with me is Pete Von Denanda. Hey, I said your name right.
Yeah.
Wow. Amazing. Oh, it's only been, what, 5 years?
Yeah, yeah, something like that. Six, actually.
Yeah.
Six since 2009.
So what normally happens is these podcasts that you and I do, basically we're talking about Fuji and then the way it relates to our photography. We normally do this right after a workshop. And we just did a workshop in February. We did the
Rajasthan one.
The Rajasthan one again. We just got so busy at the end, we didn't do the podcast. So I thought, well, why not? I mean, let's do it. There's no reason why we have to do it there in the field. Let's do it now. And since we've actually got a new workshop that we're selling, then we thought, well, this would be good timing to do both, to do the podcast and talk about all the new gear and talk about the new workshop.
Yeah. And I also remember the one before last, so the 2014 workshop, we did the podcast under a blanket in a Delhi hotel room. So maybe that's why we didn't do it again in this year.
That's
bad
kinky.
Memories. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I tell you, to be fair, though, the quality of this one may not be as good as it usually is, because usually I have my big mic and we're all wired for sound and everything. And oddly enough, I'm actually in the States where you'd think I'd have everything. But since I live in Malaysia, I came with suitcases to the States. And the one thing I didn't bring was a nice microphone. So I'm just using the mic off of the laptop here. So I hope this sounds okay for most people. Just think of it as us recording in the field.
Yeah.
So
pull up a blanket, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. What kind of things you've been doing? You did the workshop with us, but what else have you been doing? You've been doing a lot of workshops in your home country.
Oh yeah, well I've done which was really fun. I've done lots of stuff, but Fuji related. I've done two flash photography workshops with Fuji gear and Fuji users, obviously, and it was really really a lot of fun. And we made some really good images. We had a fabulous young dancer, actually two dancers at one of the workshops, and these people are amazing. They and then we used big flash, the big Jinbei flash that you also have, I believe, and we used smaller flashes and we used several flashes at once. And there's people who think that the Fuji system isn't all that good for flashes, for flash photography, but actually if there's a couple of quirks but if you know your way around them, you can do really great stuff with it. And I've kind of come to, as a result of those flash workshops, I already liked it, but I've grown even more fond of my X100 T in my case, but any X100 will do, because of its super fast sync speed, and which means that you can do a lot with a small flash. So if you use it with a big flash, like the big Jinbei 600 watt seconds, you can in the middle of the day, you can turn it into night and you can freeze action with it, like dancers jumping up and down. And it's amazing. We did some really cool stuff. So that's one of the things I've been up to.
Anything else?
Oh, no, I released a couple of preset packs in the meantime, too. Lightroom preset packs, one black and white. And now just recently, last week, a color one for color grading stuff. So I'm very into television series like Better Call Saul and all these high-end television shows, and I really love what the designers and the camera people do with the color. They kind of tweak it and turn it so it doesn't look natural, but it becomes a little bit surreal. They make the blues more cyan, and they'll make the shadows cooler and the highlights warmer and all that stuff. And that inspired me to create a Lightroom preset bundle, which I've called my color grading presets. And so I've just released that. And currently I'm working on updating my my Lightroom book for Lightroom 6.
Okay.
So that's me. And you, Matt, what have you been up to? You've been shooting a movie set.
Yeah, actually. I've been on the set of Indian Summers. It's a British drama done by the British Channel 4, which, you know, in America, when people say Channel 4, they think of a local station. But in England, Channel 4 is a network. And it's a, you know, it's equivalent to any huge network anywhere. And so they have their own shows that they produce. And this is actually the biggest budget show that they've done in years. Certainly the biggest advertising they've ever done for a show. And that's good because I'm shooting all their ad still images. And so I'm on the set about twice a week, every other week or so. They bring me in to the set, and then I shoot the actors and the certain scenes, and it's really fun because it's very much what I do when I'm out in India or something. You know, it's very sort of photojournalistic type of an approach. In fact, they hired me because this is the second year I've done it. They hired me because it seemed like everybody in Malaysia was a wedding photographer, and they needed someone with a more photojournalistic background. And so that's been keeping me busy. But then we've just recently moved back to the United States for a year as we kind of settled my daughter into university for her first year. And big change for us. We'll be empty nesters soon. Yeah, I've been doing that. Recently got the cover of Destinations magazine.
I saw that, yeah.
I guess, I don't know if listeners, if we've talked about this, but about 2 years ago, I started a nonprofit called the On-Field Media Project. And we work with other nonprofits, teaching them how to tell their story visually through photographs, videos, and then how to identify a story and how to even write that story up and share it with their public. And that's going good. We've done trainings in Indonesia and Philippines and India. We just finished one in April in Africa. It's fun. It's starting to take off, and it's really fun because it's basically what I like to do anyway, and that's teach. You know, I mean, that's why I like workshops so much. Well, okay, enough about all this stuff. Let's get into the Fuji gear here. So there's been a lot of new product come out in the last year. And
absolutely,
some fantastic lenses. You can see reviews on those. You can see the review on the lenses on my website, digitaltrekker.com. And you've got your hands on a bunch of these lenses.
Yeah, so have you, I think.
Yeah,
yeah. And a couple of were quite surprising, actually. Like, well, first of all, they don't seem to put out any really bad ones. That's amazing. They started with the X-Pro1 a couple of years ago now, and in that very short period of time, they've managed to put together a whole lens system, which is, frankly, I mean, incredible.
Let me tell you, writing reviews on these things. Okay, so I'm writing reviews, and it's, I don't want to write a review as a fanboy. I mean, people want a constructive review, right? So they want... they want to know
the bad
things as well as the good things, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard. And I'm being honest. It's hard to write a review of this stuff and not just sound like you're some fanboy.
I know. I had the same with my X100.
It's almost embarrassing because it's like, no, really, this is a great lens. You know, the only thing that I found on a lot of this stuff has been whether I would shoot that lens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's it. And which that's not a downside of any lens. That's just a matter of what your personal preference is on lens angle.
And like they've got this new 1655, and at first I thought I wouldn't like it, but then I took it to a long exposure workshop, and it's actually a pretty darn good lens. It's sharp as a tack. It's in the same realm of the 5140. Which is also absolutely killer sharp. And yeah, I mean, normally I would say the thing I would miss on the 1655 is that it's not stabilized, but I was on a tripod anyway, so I didn't bother.
And that's, you know what, that thing right there, that's probably the biggest issue with with a lot of these Fuji lenses are that several of them have come out that I thought would have been stabilized, and they're not. That's about it, I think.
Yeah, well, and then if you hear, apparently the 16-55, they didn't stabilize because it might have compromised image quality to some degree. So it's always, you know, this or that, probably. So I don't mind it. Finally, I don't mind it. I've got it. So, and I think it's one of those lenses that professionally I will use a lot. Like if I had to do a portrait of a colleague yesterday, so I reached for the 16-55 because I'll shoot it. It was a flash portrait, so I shot it at f11, or f8. I didn't really need shallow depth of field anyway, and so then I liked the versatility of the 16-55, and I didn't really miss the stabilization anyway, but. Creatively, for example, on the workshop we're about to go on to next February, I'm not sure if I'll bring the 16-55 because I think for creative purposes, I'd rather use the new 16, for example, the prime or the 90 or the 56.
Well, and let's face it, for travel photography, the 16-55 versus the 18-55. I'm not sure that the weight versus gain is there. Because it's a heavy lens.
It's heavy, yeah. If you're like here in Belgium, when I drive with my car from a job to another, and it doesn't matter that it's a heavy lens. But, you know, when you're in India and it's super hot and you're lugging your own gear around yourself all day in a bag, well, then it starts to matter what lenses you bring along. And like I say, in that case, I'd probably rather have my trusty 56 1.2 because at 1.2 I can really, you know, blow the background out of focus, whereas at 2.8 it's still out of focus but just not as much. And so I'd rather, for the same weight, for example, I'd rather have the 10-24 and the 56 rather than the 16-55. But that's a matter of the job at hand, I think.
No, I could agree completely, and that's why, to be quite honest, and this is what I want to be on these podcasts, I don't own that lens. Fuji doesn't give me lenses, and so and I know they don't give you lenses, so I think a lot of times people think they do just because we're, you know, ex-photographers. It's like, oh well, you must get all your gear free.
They pay us to use their lenses.
Wouldn't that be nice? So I don't own it, and that was one because I already own the 18-55, and I didn't use it that much.
Well, we're both more prime users, super wide angle users. So
right, we're both of those. We tend to shoot more prime, and we tend to shoot more wide.
Yeah, I actually looked it up from the last year, the 2015 the Rajasthan workshop, and I think I did 80% of my images with two lenses, being the 10-24 and the 56. So, I mean, that about says it all, doesn't it?
Now, the 10-24, I still sort of regret not buying. I don't have that lens, and there have been times that I've really regretted it because I do like the versatility of the 10-24 and I like the wide of the 10. But the thing that always frustrated me with that lens was it's a slow lens. It's f4.
Yeah. Well, but you have the 16 1.4 now.
Right. And that's what I own that one. And
Okay.
The 16 1.4, absolutely. I bought it before it was on the market. That is a benefit of having friends at Fuji. It's like, okay, thank you. They'll give us lenses to review ahead of time. And so we look at it, we get to review it, and I get to say, oh, I want this lens or I don't want this lens. So I knew right away I wanted that lens. And so I just told them, I said, look, I even before it gets to the store, I want to buy this lens. I did. And oh my gosh, that lens has, in fact, let's switch over and now talk about that 16 1.4. That has got to be probably right now my favorite lens. By the way, I've reviewed all these. You haven't done as much lens reviews, but you're kind of redoing your website now, though. So
yeah. So I first wanted to get the website right, and then I've started doing some reviews, mostly on, you know, Lightroom-related hardware and stuff. But I've done a review on how to add wireless tethering to your X-Pro1 using an SD card. So if I do reviews, they're fairly Fuji-centric, or they're just Lightroom-centric. So, but I've more done reviews about, you know, accessories like flashes and stuff like that.
Yeah, and the new Angel Bird SSD, which I'm working on a review on right now.
Okay.
Cool. Anyway, but so let's talk about the 16. Yeah. So I took this with me to Africa in April. I shot it as much as I could because I was teaching, but there was a young photographer, also named Matt, actually, Gil Uli, and he borrowed it. He just got the Fuji system, and so he borrowed that 16 1.4, put it on, and he was like a kid in a candy shop. He was just giggly over this thing, and he was just talking about how it's so sharp and so fast, and just the bokeh on it is just so gorgeous, and just goes on and on and on. And it is, I really got to tell you, it's that perfect angle. It's not too wide where you got to worry about distortion. It's not too wide to where you can still see, you know, the effects of a 1.4 in your bokeh. It's got that chuck on the front of it, you pull back.
Yeah, the clutch mechanism. Yeah.
It allows you to just sort of circumvent all of the electronic options of autofocus and just go right into manual focus right then. And it's nice. I don't do that much with manual focus, but it's the options there. But it focused fast. It's great color rendition. Everything about it was just amazing.
Well, I've recently got one too now, but I haven't, because of all the preset building that I've done lately, I haven't really had time to shoot a lot, and other than these couple of workshops. And the nice thing is that I took it. We were on a short family holiday last week, and I just took it with me to force myself to play a little bit with it. Mm-hmm. And I took photos of the our boy Noah on the beach, and so I moved in really close. And like you say, the nice thing is that because if you want to throw the background out of focus, especially on a wide angle, you have to get as close to your subject as possible, and still at 16 millimeter, it doesn't, you know, distort a lot, like you said, and that's what I like. And if you're fairly close to your subject, you can really have a beautifully out of focus background, which is on a wide angle like that. You couldn't do that, for example, with the 1655 at 2.8. Mm-hmm. It would be a whole different story. You really need that 1.4 for that. And it looks like on next year's, or on the February workshop, this will be probably be a lens I'll be using a lot. Maybe a little bit less the 10-24, and maybe a little bit more that one.
Yeah, I think you'll find once it gets on your camera, you're going to have a hard time taking it off.
Well, I have two cameras, so still have one for another lens then.
Yeah. I'm looking through some of the comments on the review as we're talking right now. We've got a couple of people like Damien Lovegrove and Gavin. They're all saying how they really like the write-up and the pictures, all that kind of stuff. But they couldn't believe how close I was getting to the subject and still not getting distortion. And because there's a couple shots on that review where I am really, really close to these people. And the fact is there is some distortion. But the way that a wide angle is done is that you have less distortion if you shoot it horizontally than if you do shoot vertically. And so by placing the subject close to the center, you can really keep a lot of that distortion from happening and get right up close to your subject. Okay, so let's look at a couple other lenses real quick. Big 5 stars on the 16. What about that 90?
Yeah, well,
that's got to be the newest lens.
Yeah, I shot with it, and it's. I think you really said it really well, because it's. I love it. It's probably the best bokeh or whatever on any lens in the Fuji lineup, which is quite a feat, because the 56 was already really nice, but this one outperforms it, I still think, in terms of bokeh. The only thing is, like, for me, I'm not used to shooting that. Like on my full frame Nikons back in the day, I didn't have a 135 2.8, for example. Mm-hmm. So I generally shot my portraits at 85, which is the equivalent of the 56 in Fuji terms. So it's I have to get used to the 90 millimeter angle of view. Other than that, the lens itself is just super. But you said it really nice. You said, yeah, I have to get used to standing in the next room to take a portrait or something in that style. I don't know how you put it. And that's, yeah, it's a lens you have to get used to. But if you're used to have a 135 millimeter and you're on full frame and you're switching or you've switched to the Fuji system, it's basically a no-brainer. And it's become a little bit boring to see all the raving reviews come out of it because I haven't read one bad review about it because you just, yeah, it's hard to say anything bad about it.
Yeah, and here's actually what I said. I said the angle of view is so narrow that to get any environment into the frame, you'd have to be standing in the next country to achieve this.
Okay.
And then I said, however, it would work very well for food photographers. Food photographers want to isolate the dish that they're shooting and the drop off in the background with milky, pleasant blur. This lens will do that perfectly. Yes, I shot this, and if you go to the review on my site and look at it, I shot this actually on the set of Indian Summers, and they actually, the producers of Indian Summers, and I got to thank them for this, they allowed me to take pictures of the next season. This is season 2 that isn't even out yet, and show pictures from that season. And so these are sort of like scoop images in a sense. Mm-hmm. They're teaser shots. You can see the depth of field on this thing is just amazing. And I tell you, you made a really good point, and I don't own this lens. I borrowed it from Fuji to do the review. This was a pre-production lens. Again, it's crazy sharp. The lead photo in the review is probably the photo, I don't know yet, but it's probably the photo I'm going to put in the Fuji X book when it comes out. I'm going to submit to that. But it's awarded me some pretty nice. Yeah, it's awarded me some pretty nice photos. The thing that you said, and I really, now I'm kind of kicking myself for not owning this lens, because I think you made a really, really astute point, and I'm just like, dang, I wish I would have bought it. And the reason I wish I would have bought it is because I had more money before I came to America. And now, putting a kid in college, I got less money to work with.
You should open a donation tab on your digital tracker blog.
Yeah. That 90 is a nice substitute for the 5140. Yeah. And that 5140 is probably almost twice as heavy and certainly bigger. Mm-hmm. And so when you're walking the streets of Delhi and stuff, that lens would actually work better for packing light with the 16 on one camera, the 51.2 sitting in the bag, and the 90 on the other camera.
Absolutely, yeah.
I think that's the ideal. That's the ideal.
Maybe like a 23 or a 35, because especially the 35, it weighs next to nothing. You can put it in your shirt pocket almost.
Yeah, I have. Yeah. In fact, I think you used to curse at me for doing that. But
if I were to have to choose between both, I'd have a really good, because they're both excellent lenses, like the 90 and the 5140, and I'd have a really tough time choosing. I think, you know, pure bokeh, I'd choose for the 90. Definitely. Versatility, obviously, the 5140 is more versatile. It's again one of the situations, if you're like a wedding photographer, you carry your gear in your car from one job to another, then you might go for the 5140 because of the flexibility and the stabilization in the church and whatnot. But if you're more on a creative workshop like the ones we do in India, you don't want to be poking big telephoto lenses into people's faces, and then I think the 90 will be better suited.
Yeah, the problem with that 90 and shooting environmental stuff, like I just said, is that you still have to be pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the frustrations for shooting, because like you said, this is the 135 equipment on a 35 millimeter, right? So I didn't shoot a 135 when I was shooting full frame. Mm-hmm. I never had it, never. But I think I could work this into my workflow. I don't know, I like the lens a lot.
It's the same with the 23mm. I never shot 35mm on my full frame. And now I love to shoot the X100T, I'd say almost in spite of the 23mm. But, you know, you learn to work with whatever lens you have. And it's actually a good exercise, I think, to sometimes, you know, leave your favorite lenses at home and try something else.
Yeah. You wrote a nice blog post. What was it? 10 accessories?
Yeah. On a number of accessories. That's true. Which I love for travel photography. Let me see if I can pull
while
that
you,
up.
While you look for the review itself, off the top of your head, what's the first thing that you would say, oh, you should get this?
The Instax printer. But I think we already covered that in a previous
I mean, I think most people that listen to our podcast
point one, my top one was a flash and a modifier. Just, you know, bring a flash and bring an umbrella, really cheap umbrella, $25, and a really cheap that's the nice thing about Fuji, because they don't have an off-camera flash system yet. Mm-hmm. You're forced to use cheap manual flashes, which is budgetary wise is a good thing. So I use two brands. I use Godox and I use Cactus. And I've really played a lot with the Cactus lately, and I also like it. The RF60, which you also have, and so that would be my number one thing, my number one accessory to bring along. And then,
also been playing with that Nissin
i40. I got my hands on one to try out for the flash workshop that we did a couple of weeks ago, and it's one of those things that I really didn't think I would like it, because it's small and it has less power than the Cactus or the Godox or the EF42, for example. But for some reason, it just fits beautifully with the entire X system. Because the other flashes that I've been using, like the Godox and the Cactus, mm-hmm. They're big flashes. They're like a Canon 560 or a Nikon SB900. So they're kind of, when you put them on a small Fuji camera, especially on like an X100T, the whole thing becomes unbalanced. So they're really meant to use off camera. If you use them on camera, like for bouncing, because I never shoot straight away, that's horrible light. So, but like for bouncing, it's a very unstable system. And the i40 is a lot lighter and a lot smaller. And I also like the form factor. It's got the same, you know, it's got a dial that you can set your exposure flash exposure compensation with. So it follows the same design and functionality of the X system, which is to provide as much as possible manual dials for everything. I've used it on my X100 a lot. And the nice thing is that even on the X100, I like to use it for bouncing, because the only time for me that I really like to have TTL control on my flash is when I'm bouncing, because, you know, if you bounce and you move around, you're subject to flash distance changes continuously, and so you would, if you were working manually, you would have to adjust your flash power continuously, so that doesn't work in practice. So I like TTL for that, and especially on, like I said in the beginning, on the X100 with a fast sync speed, you can get a lot of power out of a relatively simple flash like the i40. Now, a really cool trick is that if you, and I've been playing around with this last weekend when we were on a family cycling trip, and I just a small one-day cycling trip, and I just brought the X100 and the Nissin, and I also brought the Canon off-camera flash cord, you know, the old coiled spirally.
Yeah, it looks like an old telephone cord.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you put it in your ear, they think you're MI6 or something. So that exact cable. The beauty is that the Canon version of those cables transmits the TTL protocol of the Fuji. So you can, basically what I can do is use the Nissin i40 as a TTL off-camera flash on my Fuji system, and especially on the X100 because of its high sync speed, I can actually use an umbrella and work in broad daylight and still get fashionably lit shots. And I'm going to do a blog post on it, and like a review. Mm-hmm. And from what you hear, it's going to be a fairly favorable review because I'm really excited about this little thing. And I was wrong because I know I told you that I didn't really think much of it. But sometimes you have to try stuff. And, you know, there's a French saying that says that it's only the stupid people who don't change their mind. So that proves I'm not stupid.
Oh, and how do you say that in French?
In French, they say, il n'y a que les cons qui changent pas d'avis. Now you.
Il y a que les cons saucisses par la vie, or something.
saucisson, voilà.
Yeah. Let's look at a couple more things, and then maybe let's start talking about the workshop. I tell you one of my frustrations. Okay, this is my frustration, is, and I see that on your review that's on the UK Fuji Film blog, that one of your things is you've got the two bags, you've got several bags on here, but two bags, you have the Vanguard Heralder 38, and then you've got the Think Tank Speed Racer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I have
the model under the Speed Freak, I think. No,
The Speed Freak. I thought the difference between the Speed Racer and the Speed Freak was simply the height, not the width. But I can say that the Speed Freak that I have is just about 2 inches too narrow of the width of the bag. Because it's I have to really squeeze to get two bodies in the thing, and then put some lenses next to each other without any padding in between them, and it frustrates me. I don't normally walk around with lenses in the bag, but I still, when I go to a place or when I'm walking the streets and I don't want all my cameras out, I want to put them in the bag, but this doesn't fit. Drives me nuts.
That's why I like the Heralder so much. The other one that's on the Fuji Film UK blog, because it's a little bit bigger, and it's even got a stowaway place for a tripod. The only downside of that bag then is that because it's bigger, you tend to fill it up with more gear and say, "Oh, I'm going to bring that lens too." You know, I have. And then at the end of the day, your back aches because even on the Fuji system, which is kind of the whole reason I started using these cameras, was not to have my back ache. So, but that's because I also put in the big flashes and all that stuff. Yeah, it's still, you know, the perfect camera bag. I think it doesn't exist.
It's elusive, isn't it?
Yeah, I have like 8 of them. I think I'm afraid to admit.
I know I have something close to that, but I end up giving bags away to friends. It's,
you never gave me a bag.
Let's don't even go there. So I know you use the Heralder for not just your camera gear, though. You use it oftentimes. You'll put that Genbei flash inside
the
there,
big, yeah,
along with your tripod. Now you've got a tripod that I think works really well with the flash, and I've got to admit in this one where I was wrong on this. You have the Brian three-legged thing.
Yeah.
And I thought, what's so great about it? It's just another tripod, and you know, and frankly, most tripod, there's not that much difference, to be honest. I mean, they're graphite or they're carbon fiber or they're or aluminum. That's about it. And, you know, one will go 5 feet, one will go 6 feet. But this three-legged thing folds up. And the secret of this is the center post, it has sections like the lakes. And so...
Yeah, it keeps on going. It goes up to 2 meters. And that's the reason I like it so much. Because, like you say, it's the only tripod that does that, to my knowledge. And it's fairly expensive, otherwise, for what it is. But it allows me to have... It doubles as a light stand. And if you've seen me use it, you actually know that I've used it more as a light stand than as an actual tripod. But at 2 meters, I can light somebody in a pinch. I mean, ideally, I would like it 2.5 meter light stand, but that's just not practical. But like my old Gitzo Traveler, which cost even more than the three-legged thing one does, only came up to about 1.40 meters, which is great if you want to have a waist shot of somebody. If you want to light somebody's waist really nice, that's perfect. But if you want to light their face, you need your light to go up higher.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been using a monopod with like a video monopod that has 3 feet on it. And
not the most stable solution.
No, it's
probably.
No, it's not. It's a little scary, yeah. You know. And so I'll hold it, take a picture, hold it real quick.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Get somebody to hold it for me. This morning we were shooting some pictures, and Alu was my light stand holder.
Okay, normally she's your model, so.
Yeah. But anyway.
Did you bring the big tin bait to the States? No, you didn't.
Yeah,
did you?
I did. That's what I shot with. Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what we were using. Was the big old Genbei. So anyway, but I still want to touch base on this workshop that we've got coming up, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So the dates are February 14th through the 24th of 2016, and we are going to be touring Delhi, Agra, and Varanasi. Now, what makes each city special is Delhi is, of course... I mean, is Delhi. It's the capital of India. It is, it's got Old Delhi. Delhi is basically two cities, Old Delhi and New Delhi. Old Delhi has places like the Red Fort.
Chandni Chowk.
And Chandni Chowk. And, of course, the Jama Masjid. It is just packed full of fantastic photo ops. New Delhi has a place called Nizamuddin, the Durga. And this... place is a Sufi shrine, and every workshop we do in India, whether people have been there before or not, they always want to go back to Nizamuddin, and they always want to shoot it.
We could actually do a 10-day workshop in Delhi and not be bored at the end of the 10th day, but we just wanted to do some other locations as well. But it's just so incredibly versatile, and there's so many color and texture and great faces, and it's the in a way it's the ideal entry city for India photography workshop, I think.
Yeah, it is. And so on day one, we arrive in Delhi. Day two, we'll be going to Old Delhi and Chandni Chowk. And then in the afternoon, we'll go to Nizamuddin. And we're not spending a lot of time in Delhi. But then on day three, we're going to go by minibus from Delhi to Agra. Now, now what makes Agra so special is it's the Taj Mahal. That's where the Taj Mahal is located. And, of course, there are so many people that have come to India, and the only thing they want to do is see the Taj Mahal. And it's actually a mausoleum, a tomb. But being completely made of white marble, it does amazingly weird things with the light. And so in the morning, the whole structure is a sort of a different color than it is in the afternoon, than it is in the evening.
I've read the program, so we'll be shooting it from the morning, from the evening, from all kinds of different angles. So we're really going to help participants to get like the iconic Taj Mahal shot, and then a couple of, you know, lesser known, but maybe for that reason, potentially better shots or more interesting shots. So we're going to work the place really hard. That's for sure.
Yeah, we do what we tell people. We're going to work the shot. So we're gonna do that. Then we're going to take some time and we'll visit a place called Fatehpur Sikri, which was it's a deserted city. And by deserted city, you got to understand this is different. It's not a city like you might find a ghost town in the Old West or something like that. This is a city that they actually abandoned because they ran out of water. And so all the buildings are still in these amazing shapes. And it's not like just destroyed. In many ways, it's more of what you might think of a ghost town in a sense, because it feels like people just left yesterday in some ways. And it's really interesting. So that's Fatehpur Sikri. Day five, we take a train overnight from Agra to Varanasi.
Always an experience, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're going to Varanasi. Now,
I'm most excited about that, obviously.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you're excited because you've never been there, right?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, and
but I trust you because you've been there like
I don't know
a zillion times.
Well, three or four times I've been there, and,
okay.
And it's. Varanasi is just an amazing, colorful city. It's the most holy city for the Hindus in the world, and certainly in India. And this is where it's right on the edge of the Ganges, and so they come there, and that's where they do their ritual bathing. They have cremation ghats there where they'll burn the bodies. Now we won't be able to take pictures of the cremation. They frown upon that, and you know that's
we always try to respect whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And rules are. And frankly, it's just kind of tacky. I mean, why do you want that? You know,
there's other stuff to shoot, right. Obviously.
But anyway, there's tons of stuff to shoot. In fact, if you come to the website, the URL is pretty easy. We'll have it with this podcast. I think Varanasi, I mean, it is probably the most exciting part of the trip. You know, it really isn't any more exciting for someone who hasn't been to India than any of the other places. But for those of us that have been to some of the other places, this is just holding some really special opportunities. We'll take a boat ride on the Ganges itself and rowboats and out in front of the ghats to be able to shoot the city from the water. And then we'll shoot the city from the sides of the river, and then we'll shoot it from building tops, and then walk the back streets of Varanasi.
Yeah, we're going to work our point of view. Absolutely.
Everything, yep.
Yeah, the thing I like about it is that, and why I'm so excited about it is that, and I hope other people will share that excitement, is that whenever I see an image of India that I really for some reason strikes me, and then I look at the caption, 9 chances out of 10 is that it's shot in Varanasi. So it's like, and I know the great shots that are to be had in Delhi and the other places, in the other Rajasthan workshop that we do. So I'm thinking, like, if this is already so good, then if Varanasi is even better, then must be photographer's paradise, basically. And that's why we spend quite a lot of time in there too.
So that's it in a nutshell. I think it's going to be a fantastic trip. If you are a former participant of one of our tours, we give you a discount. You can email us for the code for that. So we'd love to have you February 14th through the 24th, 2016. I think that's going to have to be it. I think we've kind of run out of all the time we can.
Yeah.
We hope that you've enjoyed and maybe gotten a couple of hints and tips along the way. There's a lot of good stuff happening with Fuji, and we're proud to be associated with them. And we hope you join us on the workshop coming up in February.
Yeah. And check our blogs for the relevant links to those things that we discussed.
That's right. We'll have all the reviews and everything all linked up with this podcast. So don't make yourself a stranger. Come on by. And your website, Pete, is what?
www.morethanwords.be.
Okay.
And yours is, Matt?
TheDigitalTrekker.com. And that's Trekker, T-R-E-K-K-E-R. All right.
Okay. And thanks. Don't forget, il y a que les cons qui changent pas la vie.
Absolutely. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Lucy! Please hang up and try again.
He's looking at you, kid.
You've been listening to TheDigitalTrekker.com. I'm Matt Brandt.
And that's all, folks.